thank you, everybody. Welcome back after the break. The second session is of critical importance to Bangladesh and the international system because the session is on the threat of rising militancy and terrorism in Bangladesh, an issue which is talked not only in Bangladesh but everywhere else. How great is the threat? In this panel, we have two speakers. We had two speakers. And the first speaker was Colonel Thomas Lynch of the National Defense University, and the second speaker beside me, Shafkat Munir. Unfortunately, Tom Gall followed out because the government shut down. But the other side of the story is, while the government shuts down, terrorists and militants don't shut down. So they work 24/7, and for that reason, I think the session must go on. Our speaker today is Mr. Shafkat Munir, who is currently an associate research fellow at the Bangladesh Institute of Peace and Security Studies. Prior to this present work, he has also worked as senior analyst with the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies at the Nanyang Technological University in Singapore, and specializing on terrorism issues. He subsequently worked with the Singapore Technologies in their Homeland Security Division, again specializing on terrorism issues and transnational threats. His interest and specialization focus on militancy and terrorism, and he's also closely associated with the Bangladesh Center of Terrorism Research, which is a constituent body of BIPS, or Bangladesh Institute of Peace and Security Studies. Mr. Munir also concurrently works for the Jain's Group of Publications and currently looks after Bangladesh, Nepal, and Myanmar, being stationed in Bangladesh. His recent article in the Jain's Intelligence Review cover story in the June publication was titled "On Bangladesh, Situation Critical." And that's a cover story we have shared with our host, and you may be able to pick up some of the copies when you go out. What I would like to say is that, to start with, the threat of radicalization and terrorism in Bangladesh is real and is serious. And it falls in the what is the so-called arc of instability, starting from Afghanistan, Pakistan to India, and now hovers onto Bangladesh. The threat of radicalization and grassroots in Bangladesh is rapidly happening. And Bangladesh has faced operational terrorism in the past, happening from the late 90s onto the present time. We are also particularly concerned in the region as United States pulls out of Afghanistan. What are the situation of spillover effects into the region, including Bangladesh? For the reason that most of the known terrorist groups in Bangladesh that has operated are members who led the organizations are all members of what is being now called the Afghan alumni. So they have roots back to the Afghan Jihad, where they have participated and came back to found the groups in Bangladesh and started the operations in different guise and different names and different groups. So once the United States pulls out of Afghanistan, many of the resurgent groups in the Afghan landscape will try and reestablish their prior contacts with groups in the region, including Bangladesh. Therefore, we see the possibility of reconnecting with old friends and colleagues and masters. We see the possibility that many of the training facilities that are available to Bangladesh groups in Afghanistan will again fall open. We see the possibility that many of these groups that have transnational and regional linkages will again revitalize themselves in establishing the regional networks. I don't want to go on further, but I will come in whenever possible in the discourse that we'll have over the next 1 hour. But I will now turn it over to Shafkat to give his presentation. Then we shall open up for question and answer session and a free-flowing discussion. So Shafkat, it's over to you.
Thank you so much. At the outset, it's a real pleasure to be here this morning, and my personal appreciation to the American Security Project, with whom we have worked very closely together in putting this event together this morning. As the moderator has very rightly mentioned, that the problem of terrorism and extremism in Bangladesh is a matter of pressing concern, not only for Bangladesh, but for the region, and also for the policy community in the United States, because it has serious imprint on regional stability. Bangladesh has faced a sustained challenge from terrorism and extremism for more than a decade. The problem of terrorism and extremism has been further compounded in Bangladesh due to other security, development, and governance challenges. In the first two decades of its existence as a nation state, Bangladesh had to counter problems of left-wing extremism and an ethno-nationalist insurgency in the southeast of the country. However, as the moderator has mentioned in his opening remarks, a turning point was the end of the Afghan jihad in the late 80s and the early part of the 90s, when many of the Bangladeshi individuals who had formed the ranks of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan came back. And that led to the emergence of various organizations, some of which are very well known today, like the Jamaatul Mujahideen Bangladesh, JMB, or the Harkatul Jihad Islami Bangladesh, HUJB, all of which came into being between the period 1992 and 1998. The problem became complex in the mid-90s and reached a serious level after 1996. Not only did we see the emergence of new terrorist groups, but we also saw terrorist attacks by Islamist militant groups for the first time. They attacked cultural programs, they attacked political meetings, and also cultural celebrations like the Bengali New Year celebration in Dhaka in April 2001. We also saw attacks on government installations during this period. So what I intend to do today, ladies and gentlemen, is to give you a brief overview about the threat landscape, and then go into talking about what are the measures for counterterrorism that are currently being taken, and what are the measures that need to be taken to manage this problem in the Bangladeshi context. In terms of the threat landscape, we see currently from our research there are over 36 to 38 groups that are in operation, out of which 4 to 5 have been banned, and the ones that are most prominent are the ones I mentioned earlier, Jamaatul Mujahideen Bangladesh or Harkatul Jihad Islami Bangladesh, or some of their affiliate groups like Allah Dol, or previously what was known as JMJB, Jamaatul Jagrata Muslim Janata Bangladesh. But what is also alarming is that the recent emergence of splinter groups. Our institute, the Bangladesh Institute of Peace and Security Studies, has just brought out copies of a special report on the emergence of splinter groups, copies of which would be available if you would like one. And we have looked at how these new splinter groups, namely Ansarullah Bangla Team, BEM, or Tamiruddin, and how they are also contributing to the changing threat matrix in Bangladesh. When we look at terrorism and extremism in Bangladesh, I think the factor of Afghanistan is very important. And what the moderator has mentioned about the Afghan alumni network, we need to pay particular attention to. The people who form the pioneering ranks of groups such as JMB or HUJI learned the ropes of their trade in places like Khokst, Paktika, and other provinces in Afghanistan where they were present during the Afghan jihad. Their experience in Afghanistan allowed them to forge close ties with groups such as Al-Qaeda, groups in Southeast Asia, and also other groups in South Asia like the Lashkar-e-Tayyiba. It is no surprise, therefore, that when HUJI was formed in 1996, it did receive a personal endorsement from Osama bin Laden, and there are some studies which suggest that they even received some financial support from Al-Qaeda. Of late, we have seen in the period 2009 to 2011, several arrests of terrorists belonging to Lashkar-e-Tayyiba, Jaish-e-Mohammed, and other groups in Bangladesh. So what I would like to underscore at this particular point of time is that the threat as we see in Bangladesh also has regional ramifications and not ramifications only for Bangladesh's security. What is also important to note is that these groups have been steadfastly opposed to what the previous speakers in panel one have talked about, the linguistic and cultural characteristics of Bangladesh's national identity. In analyzing the strategic intent, what I have seen from my research, that they, if we look at their strategic intent and their selection of targets during various attacks, including the serial bomb blasts and other major attacks that have taken place, they have continually attacked matters of occasions of cultural significance, government installations, and anything that represents the state structure and also the linguistic and cultural identity of Bengalis in Bangladesh. So, although quite often when I talk about terrorism in Bangladesh, especially in Dhaka, a question that I'm often posed with is that there have been no successful attacks since 2007. So is it really a major problem? And the standard refrain or the standard answer that I have to that question is that it is true that thankfully, touch wood, there have been no successful terrorist attacks in Bangladesh since 2007, largely a testament to the sustained effort the successive governments have taken in terms of operational counterterrorism. But the absence of a terrorist attack does not indicate the absence of the terrorist threat. And it remains a clear and present danger. And the manifestation of the threat in the form of this emergence of the splinter groups is something that's a major wake-up call for us once more. In the post-9/11 environment, when Bangladesh was plagued with a whole spate of terrorist violence, some major counterterrorism measures were taken by the then government in power, which was led by the Bangladesh Nationalist Party. And I would just like to highlight some of the key institutional steps that were taken, which successive governments have built on, including the current government, and have taken it forward. It started with the signing of the MOU for the terrorist interdiction program with the United States in March 2004. It went hand in hand with initiating cooperation mechanisms with other countries such as Australia, United Kingdom, and Canada. It also led to the creation of dedicated counterterrorism intelligence capacity within our security agencies, creation of specialized units within the police force who have been at the vanguard in some of the major counterterrorist operations that have taken part in the country, and also efforts to target financing of terrorism, particularly looking at the traditional as well as the non-traditional sources. And also, I'd like to produce some numbers here. An apprehension of 1,177 terrorists and extremists, including key figures of JMB and Hujibi. So in terms of operational measures, Bangladesh has been quite successful over the last decade. We have seen some major, we have made some major inroads in terms of operational successes. And there have been some strategic measures. However, I would like to stress at this point that a lot of our actions have been kinetic and operational in nature. And what we really need right now in terms of counterterrorism in Bangladesh is a more strategic approach. And there are some issues that I would like to highlight in my presentation which merit attention. Prison radicalization is becoming a major concern in Bangladesh. So what is happening is that terrorists are being apprehended after a lot of toil and hard work by the law enforcement and security agencies. They're going in. But due to the absence of proper legislation and legal framework, I mean, although we have a Counterterrorism Act, but there are, of course, rooms for improvement in that. When they're produced before court, sometimes due to lack of prosecutorial abilities or other legal loopholes, they're either given a short sentence or in some cases they're released. And when they're put in prison, because there is no proper rehabilitation program in place, what often happens or what has been noticed that, A, they get out of prison very fast because the case against them is not very strong. B, they're also exposed to hardline ideas while they cohabit in the same prison cell with other terrorists and militants. And the case of repeat offenders has been quite high. I did a study myself where I looked at how many terrorists are apprehended and how many of them are second-time offenders. and the number was quite high. And I'm talking about the period 2008-09, and I'm afraid I don't think the reality has changed much in the last few years. So there are some key issues that Bangladesh needs to look at in terms of fashioning a strategic approach towards counterterrorism. The other point that I want to highlight at this point is that, which is very closely related to the discussion on panel one. As confrontational politics looms large on our horizon, and as a lack of bipartisan approach to any issue, particularly issues of national security, are a reality of the day for us in Bangladesh, the terrorists and militants are constantly taking advantage of that. In a fractious, confrontational, and dare I say, toxic political environment that permeates the system in Bangladesh, and a lack of proper dialogue, what often happens is that the terrorists and militants try to take advantage of the situation to perpetuate their own goals. For instance, before the previous elections in 2008, we saw a spike in terrorist activity, including a foiled operation where they tried to set an explosion at a political rally of the current leader of the opposition, Begum Khaleda Zia, during one of her electoral rallies. And we envisage that there might be a spike of the threat or terrorist activity again as the elections are quite near. The other problem that bedevils a lot of counterterrorism efforts is the lack of bipartisan approach and counterterrorism becoming a part of campaign sloganeering. And it is very important, therefore, that counterterrorism as an issue needs to be delinked from politics and a bipartisan approach needs to be forged. What is also important is sensitizing the people about the threat of terrorism and creating greater awareness about the terrorist threat. We're very happy to see that the international community, especially the United States, has been very forthright and forthcoming in providing help to Bangladesh right from the start in terms of capacity building, in terms of financial assistance, in terms of training assistance. And such efforts are really important because a country of Bangladesh's size, which is beset with so many development and governance challenges and other day-to-day challenges, we have a challenge from climate change, which is also a topic of today's conference, and so many other development and governance challenges that our governments are continually faced with. Without proper support from the international community, it won't be possible for us to fashion the right counterterrorism approach. So I think the international community has a very important role to play. And as the withdrawal from Afghanistan happens in 2014, we are very concerned about the spillover effect, because we saw, as I have highlighted just a short while ago, what happened when the previous withdrawal happened in 89 and what that resulted in. So we in Bangladesh remain very concerned about what kind of effects the 2014 withdrawal will have on the terrorist threat landscape in Bangladesh. Our institute just held a conference about 2.5 weeks back, which was titled Afghanistan Beyond 2014 Implications for South Asia, where we looked at quite elaborately how the spillover effect is likely to take place and how what kind of measures that Bangladesh needs to take to combat this challenge. As the electoral exercise is quite close, we see that both parties, the current government and the current opposition, are constantly talking about the threat of militancy and the countermeasures that need to be taken. And in my own conversations or through in the course of my research with representatives from both sides, we have noted with interest that both of them want to further the counterterrorism agenda. And in the case of the opposition, there have been some major statements which have been made of late, including a statement in Parliament by the leader of the opposition where she underscored the importance of countering terrorism and the measures that need to be taken. I think what is quite critical at this point, and that brings me to the second part of my presentation, is a fresh look at Bangladesh's counterterrorism structure or counterterrorism architecture. Because without a proper review of the architecture, without a proper review of our counterterrorism efforts, I'm afraid a lot of our efforts would not be successful. There are some issues that I want to highlight at this point. And what we have seen in the course of our research and in also our conversations with different political parties, including the opposition, that there are certain plans in store to overhaul the structure. In terms of overhauling the structure, there are two particular issues that also need to be highlighted. First is the issue of regional cooperation. Unfortunately, in South Asia, I mean, there are many South Asia watchers in this room, so all of us are aware of the bitter reality that the states have not been able to find a good cooperative mechanism. Regionalism hasn't really taken off in South Asia. SAARC still remains a work in progress, nearly 30 years after its existence. And in the absence of a proper South Asian security architecture, in the absence of a proper working or functional relationship in terms of security cooperation in South Asia, quite often the advantage is taken by transnational groups, including transnational terrorist groups. While the states may not talk or the states may find it difficult to work with each other, we see an excellent level of cooperation among South Asian terrorist organizations. Some of it that has been manifested in the cooperation that has been witnessed in between Bangladeshi terrorist groups and groups such as LET and Jaish-e-Mohammed, in terms of finding refuge, in terms of finding space, also in terms of exchanging operational know-how. So what is critical from Bangladesh's perspective and also from the region's perspective is to foster greater regional cooperation. And we believe that Bangladesh is in a position to act as a catalyst for greater regional cooperation, greater regional understanding on issues of counterterrorism. What is also important, ladies and gentlemen, is for Bangladesh to have a very categoric and clear stand on complete denial of space for any terrorist groups in its country, both local and foreign. And that would be an important confidence-building measure which will go towards enhancing regional cooperation on counterterrorism. I note with alarm a recent statement by the head of the Border Security Force, which was made of India, which was made just, I think, a few days back, that despite a lot of efforts that have been taken by successive governments, there are still over 30 Indian terrorist organizations which are apparently operating out of Bangladesh territory. I haven't had a chance to delve much deeper into it, but what I would like to state at this point, that even if a percentage of that number is true, or even if that portion of that assertion has any merit to it, it's a matter of deep concern, because operations of such groups in Bangladesh territory not only endanger the security of our neighbor, but also potentially and rightly endanger the security of our own country as well. Because when one terrorist group comes and operates in another's territory, it's an interesting quid pro quo that happens. So in exchange for space, in exchange for support, in exchange for the logistical backup that the Bangladeshi or groups or a group in a particular host country may provide, they take operational know-how and, what is very important for terrorist groups, the financial lifeblood. So I think it's very important for us to take these issues very seriously. In terms of looking at the CT architecture, there are some key issues that need to be highlighted. And I note that it's a matter of encouragement for me as a counterterrorism analyst that the political actors are taking this issue seriously. And as I said, that in our conversations with the opposition, we have seen that they also have certain agendas in place on how they want to further the development of the CT architecture. I think one critical issue that we have identified in Bangladesh's case is the lack of an overarching body to coordinate all counterterrorism measures. There are a lot of different units, a lot of different agencies which are engaged in operational and primarily operational, but some strategic CT. But in the absence of an overarching body, the lack of coordination often complicates their efforts. So therefore, the creation of a national counterterrorism authority with an appropriate person of an appropriate rank and status as its head, as an apex body to coordinate all counterterrorism efforts, is an absolute imperative. What is also important is to look at counterterrorism, not just terrorism, the tactic, but as the whole continuum, starting from radicalization, extremism, and terrorism. So in tandem with a proper counterterrorism policy, Bangladesh needs to fashion a counter-extremism strategy. Because what we see in recent times that in addition to terrorist groups, we also face a grave challenge from extremist organizations. Some of those extremist organizations who have not yet graduated to the level of operational terrorism still pose a critical threat to the national security of our state. It is also important for Bangladesh, and when it looks at its city architecture, to look at the issue of radicalization. And successive governments have tried to address this issue, and what I hear that some plans are being talked about to come up with a counter-radicalization strategy. What I have said in my various presentations before, and what I would also like to highlight today, this morning here, is that if we look at the issue of terrorism and extremism in Bangladesh purely as an ideological issue, I think we would be slightly missing the point. Ideology is very important. Ideology plays a very galvanizing role on what drives an individual to be prepared to kill or maim hundreds of other individuals. But at the same time, there are certain pecuniary privations or other reasons that also need to be taken into account. I think one of the members of the audience said posed a question about corruption in the previous panel and was talking about an anecdote. So let me present an anecdote to you. The individual we are talking about, his name is Bomber Mizan. That's his sort of nom de guerre, but his name is Mizanur Rahman. He was the chief explosives expert of Jamaatul Mujahideen Bangladesh, who was apprehended in 2010. And during the course of the investigation, the law enforcement agencies found out that he had been living in a flat, the rent of which was paid by the terrorist group. The education of his children was paid by the terrorist group. And there were sort of insurance policies, for the lack of a better word, in place that if he is apprehended or if he dies during an operation, how his family will be looked after. In a state or a society where lack of service delivery, lack of governance, and a developmental deficit bedevils us every single day, the kind of economic security that these groups have been able to provide is also a significant factor in their ability to draw people to their ranks. I am not discounting the fact that ideology has been a very important factor and people are not flocking to join terrorist groups purely for financial reasons, but I think it's also important to take note of the socio-political environment that is prevalent in Bangladesh and how these groups are exploiting that. For the course of my cover story, which I did for Jane's Intelligence Review, I interviewed a governance practitioner and some people in the development sector. And I was particularly struck by one statement given by a gentleman. He said, and I quote, that the kind of disenfranchised, disenchanted quality that we have in the rural areas of Bangladesh and the kind of problems they face due to lack of service delivery and other issues creates, in his words, a red carpet environment for extremism. And I'm afraid that over the period of time, we haven't really looked particularly at that issue. And when we look at the overhaul of the city architecture and structure, this is one particular issue that we need to definitely look at. Legislation is a matter of major concern. The Counterterrorism Act that is currently in place, there needs to be a comprehensive review to see how we can address the legislative or the legal loopholes, how we can make the legislation stronger in line with the best practices followed by other countries to ensure that we can lessen the threat of repeat offenders. Crisis management is also another important issue that Bangladesh needs to look at. So in the event of a terrorist attack or any other man-made disaster, the lack of a proper central body for coordinating crisis management has been found to be a major weakness. So when we have had terrorist attacks in the country, the kind of crisis management mechanism that immediately needed to kick into place wasn't there. So in future, to deal with such eventualities, a proper crisis management strategy needs to be prepared and a national crisis management center needs to be created. And I'm happy to see that some plans are already in place to do so. We also face a threat from the maritime domain. Bangladesh is a key littoral state in the Indian Ocean region. And in view of the Mumbai attacks and some of the other recent events, I think the threat from the maritime domain, not only from terrorists, but also from piracy and other threats, needs to be seriously looked at. Because I think what is very important for us in Bangladesh is to keep in mind that terrorism is not in isolation. It is also in conjunction with other transnational threats that the country faces. Training and capacity building is another major area, and Bangladesh has been quite active in fostering regional counterterrorism research and training. Our institute has also been part of that whole agenda. We have tried to foster regional counterterrorism capacity building and training. So I think there's a lot of opportunity to take that forward. We also need to initiate a review of our measures to deal with left-wing extremism, because Bangladesh not only faces a challenge from Islamist militancy, but also a serious challenge from left-wing extremism. Professor Ali Riaz, who was a panelist in the first panel, has done quite a bit of work on that, so I'd be keen to hear his comments on that too. So left-wing extremism is another major challenge which we need to look at. And also what is important is to look at the aspect of madrasas, madrasa curriculum, its impact on potential radicalization, and whether a review of the madrasa curriculum is warranted. So in short, that's just an overview of the threat of terrorism and extremism that plagues Bangladesh, what can be done to manage the threat. And let me end by saying that it's a clear and present danger that we live with. We have seen how it has posed a critical threat to our national security in previous years. And although we have not seen any manifestation of operational terrorism in the last few years, it's a threat that we live with. And it's our effort as members of the counterterrorism response community to start the discourse towards a whole of government and whole of society approach towards counterterrorism. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Shafkat. Thank you for that wonderful presentation. What I would like to say that the threat is real and the threat is grave. We in the Institute have been engaging political stakeholders on both sides and are happy to say that I see a commitment on both sides. I'm also particularly encouraged by the fact that a lot of the city architecture issues that Shafkat has been talking about are now being endorsed by the opposition party in Bangladesh. So the opposition is talking about a very progressive, very modern and forward-looking architecture for counterterrorism or city architecture, in which the key salients are going to be a national counterterrorism authority with a person in charge with cabinet rank to have direct access to the prime minister so that he can bring issues to her attention. The opposition is also talking about creating institutional capacity in the form of maritime security or maritime counterterrorism center. They are talking about creation of a cybersecurity center, because we are absolutely non-starter on this area of cybersecurity, and cyberterrorism threat is looming large everywhere in the world. We are also being faced with other challenges from other domains that need to be addressed. And when we engage the policymakers and stakeholders in the opposition party, they have also talked about issues such as information fusion center, which is very, very modern and progressive, where the flow of information will come, get synthesized, and being disseminated back to the utilizers or stakeholders in various capacities. They have talked about a regional counterterrorism center, where South Asians will have counterterrorism capacity building and have linkages back to other capitals so that there is a city cooperation that is being developed as a regional capacity. They have also talked about a very robust counter-money laundering process in Bangladesh, because that is a major weakness in our system. We have been unable to stop the flow of money going to terrorist organizations. So the opposition has been talking about legislating a very robust and a very powerful counter-money laundering regime in Bangladesh that can have an effective stoppage of money flowing into terrorist organizations. So I'm, as a As a person in the business of counterterrorism community, I am happy to report to you that the current government has shown its commitment by following the legislative capacity that was forged and legislated by the opposition party when they're in power, and they've taken it forward. And now, when we come near the election, I see again a very progressive looking opposition outlook towards counterterrorism. So on the whole, I see that there is a deep political commitment to this, and that is a positive sign as we face the challenges of radicalization and terrorism in Bangladesh. With that, I'll open the floor to any questions and comments. Please raise your hand, and we'll take a couple of questions in a cluster, and then ask Shafkat to respond. Sir, the last gentleman on the last row.
Good morning, my name is Sam Warner with Radical Enterprises. It's great to hear about the concern about terrorist groups emerging from India. My question is, what about the groups from Myanmar that are currently possibly operating in Bangladesh? And the second part is, have you been able to establish links with other members of ASEAN, particularly Philippines, Thailand, and Indonesia, who are currently have major CT programs currently underway?
Sir, you have the floor. Next person in front of you.
Hi, my name is Lassar. I'm an entrepreneur and tech guy from Bangladesh. One of the questions was that, how do you see the spread of internet spread among the community now, social media, and among the youthful demographic of Bangladesh become a problem? Because we know there's a lot of, among Facebook, a lot of propaganda is spread very fast and it's been used already. So how do you see that as a future problem, and how do you address that?
Anybody in this slot? Okay, ma'am, you have the floor. Microphone here, please. Here.
I want to talk about like polarization in rural areas. You talk about architecture a lot, but I want to take it literally. How do these terrorist organizations target youth, I guess, youth in rural areas who don't have lack of education? And do you see the potential spread of Sharia law in these areas?
Right, let me start with the question about Myanmar and also links with Southeast Asia. Yes, you're absolutely right. I think Myanmar is a key factor when we look at the challenges that our Bangladesh is facing from terrorism and extremism. There are two particular groups of Rohingya groups, the Arakan Rohingya Solidarity Organization and the Rohingya National Organization who have been, Arakan Rohingya National Organization and Rohingya Solidarity Organization, or RSO, who have been operating. And we also note with alarm the increasing rise of fundamentalism among the Buddhist community in Myanmar, particularly Time magazine had an interesting cover story which said the face of Buddhist terror with Abbot Wiratu's picture on it. So I think the key developments that are taking place in Myanmar are of particular importance to Bangladesh, and that is something we really need to look into as we look at countermeasures. In terms of linkages with Southeast Asia, if I understood you correctly, you're talking about linkages in terms of counterterrorism or?
Yes.
Yeah, right. The Jakarta Center for Regional Counterterrorism has been a model that Bangladesh has studied quite actively, and both at a governmental level and also at a non-governmental level. And the kind of counterterrorism cooperation in ASEAN that we see. I've spent 5 years working in an ASEAN country, namely Singapore, and I have done a lot of work on looking at the counterterrorism architecture that Singapore and other the strategies that they have in place. I think that's a best practice model that Bangladesh can definitely look at. But primarily, I would like to highlight that the Southeast Asian Center for Counterterrorism that's located in Jakarta is a model that we have been studying, and our efforts at fostering greater capacity building and regional cooperation in South Asia would take very key lessons from that. Coming back to the question posed by the gentleman, I think you're absolutely right. Urban radicalization is becoming a major issue in Bangladesh. So the sort of center of gravity of radicalization has shifted from the rural areas into the urban centers. We see that in private universities in Dhaka, which are generally the student body is a bit more affluent in nature compared to the state universities, because private universities, as you can understand, are more expensive. We see creeping growth of extremist groups in various forms and sizes. These groups have been making very assiduous use of the internet. You will be surprised if I give you certain stories about the use of internet. I mean, it was quite surprising for me as a city analyst to read that peer-to-peer network sharing, chat groups, bulletin boards, you name it, all of that has been used by terrorist groups. One splinter group, which the law enforcement agencies recently discovered, were using mock websites to impart training and share technical know-how. So I think we really need to look at the cyber domain with alacrity, and with we need to see how we can counter the threat. To answer the lady's question on how the rural populace are fall prey to radicalization, because if I understand you correctly, lack of education and other, I think the overall lack of service delivery and their increasing disenchantment with the system is something that the terrorist and extremist groups are exploiting. If we look at a particular attack which took place in 2005 when judges were attacked, and the strategic communication material that JMB had released after that, and I have an opportunity to analyze that, they were quite categoric in their statement that these people have failed to deliver, namely the judges who were killed. They routinely engaged in corruption, and they immediately struck a chord with the people who did condemn what was done to them. They didn't approve of the fact that those people were killed in a terrorist attack, but at some level there was some resonance with the fact that, the state or the system has failed to deliver. So again, I would like to emphasize the point that these groups are exploiting that fault line, and it is incumbent upon the state to realize that and ensure that service delivery, governance, and the developmental deficit can be addressed. I think that's an imperative.
Any other questions or comments? We can still take a few questions if you want to. All right, if there are none, I would like to say that...
I have a question.
Oh, please.
Shafkat, I mean, do you have a figure?
Microphone.
Figure about number of people who have been recruited from for example, madrasa-educated youths, or Qaumi madrasa-educated youths, because my information, I'm according to what I'm not an expert in this, but you know, the terrorist groups are usually, even those who are bands, like Hizbul Tahrir and others, they're well educated, they're not madrasa people.
Yeah, I don't have, I'm afraid, ma'am, I don't have an exact figure, but I think, yeah, you have hit the right point here. It is not particularly right to look at that the traditional discourse that we often saw that, yeah, terrorist groups only go and recruit from Qaumi madrasas. Because if we look at some of the people who have formed the ranks of Hizb ut-Tahrir, they were Western-educated individuals. They were people who had gone to the best universities. The head of Hizb ut-Tahrir who was arrested, Mr. Muhyiddin, was a faculty member in our premier business school. And I have known people who were his students and classmates at university. They never realized for a moment that this individual could any day be involved with Hizb ut-Tahrir. So I think it's not that simple. It's not that linear. I think there needs to be a sort of fresh look at these things. That, of course, a madrasa curriculum is a matter of importance. It's a matter of concern which needs to be looked into to ensure that the Qaumi madrasas equip their students with the right skill sets for the workforce so that we don't create a whole pool of people who are completely ill-equipped to meet the challenges after they complete the K-12 education process. But at the same time, the kind of, I think there has been a change, and that's, again, that brings me to my point of urban radicalization. The universities where you were associated with, there have been a certain growth of extremist activity. There have been arrests of people belonging to foreign terrorist organizations from these groups or foreign extremist organizations. So I think we need to take a fresh look. And again, I would like to highlight that a sort of linear understanding of these issues, which we often see in Bangladesh and also in other countries, is not right. I think there needs to be a more holistic approach.
So I think, you know, you should inform the American audience that the Qaumi madrasas, those who are not under the government government education board,
right.
You know, they have their own board.
Mm.
And we don't exactly know what their curriculum is and what to do with those institutions. Are mostly funded by Saudi Arabia. I mean, what do we do about it?
Well, what I would say is that, for the benefit of the audience, Bangladesh has two streams of madrasa education. One is called the Aliyah Madrasa Education, the Aliyah system, which is controlled by the government. They're provided budget by the government. The education that they go through is certified by the government, so they have a marketable skill going back into the job market. This is the smaller number. A very large and a vast number of the madrasa schools are in the Qaumi Madrasa system, which are completely unregulated, unfunded by the state, and they are uncertified by the state. So the qualifications that they get after going through the system for many years are not marketable in the job market.
Mm.
So the only way for them to get back into the job market is to be plowed back into the madrasa network again. So here there is a complete failure of the state to deliver. The state has not existed in the space where the Qaumi madrasas have come and fill up that space. It is classical, the Hamas factor. Where the state did not deliver, the Qaumi madrasas have delivered that to the people. So therefore we see the madrasa education structure in Bangladesh is highly problematic. It is not only because the problems have come and they have generated themselves, it is also the state and the governments have failed. Therefore, there has to be a fresh look at the whole system on a holistic basis, not on a case-to-case basis. And that is a must. I would also like to say that we have to take out the politics out of the system. As Shafkat very rightly said, that we have to depoliticize counterterrorism.
Mm.
One of the biggest flaws of the current government's approach to counterterrorism, they take counterterrorism as a political ploy to beat up the opposition, defame the opposition, and said that we are the only ones who are saving the country. That is not the story.
Mm.
The story is both political parties have shown equal commitment to the cause of counterterrorism, and they have to be encouraged that they continue the speed and the work on a depoliticized basis. The moment you bring up very confrontational politics into counterterrorism, the only people who benefit are the terrorists, and nobody else benefits. The system does not benefit. I would like to also add here, in addition to what Shafkat said, that we see a rising kind of a trend of urban radicalization and recruitment to terrorist groups. We are also now seeing a huge space being opened up to female radicalization. So we have also had now new cases where we are seeing female operatives operating on the ground on an operational basis with terrorist organizations. So this is a new phenomenon that has come up altogether. And we are now seeing the splinter groups that have come into operation in Bangladesh. So that is again a new addition to the landscape. We're also seeing that very sophisticated, affluent urban youth are being recruited by groups like Hizbut Tahrir. Hizbut Tahrir, for your information, is not an operational terrorist group. They don't go and blow up bridges and houses and blow bombs. What they do is they work on the minds and hearts of people, particularly young people, and put the seed of radicalization and terrorism into their minds and hearts. The university where the professor is teaching is becoming a hotbed of the breeding ground for young, affluent urban terrorists and radicals. And unfortunately, one of our young fellows who just got prosecuted in New York and got a life term happens to be from your university, and I don't think we are proud of this. But the fact remains, this is a problem we need to address. The good thing about Bangladesh, the good thing about our political parties, we are not in a state of denial.
Exactly.
We accept the problem, we want to face the challenge very squarely as Bangladeshis and cooperate with our international friends and partners. Shafkat.
No, I think I completely agree with the chair on this, and I would just like to highlight that an aspect that for the paucity of time that we haven't had much time to look at is the aspect of radicalization among the diaspora. And what I particularly want to underscore is the case of Nafis in New York, and also the case of the person who was arrested for plotting to bomb a British Airways aircraft in 2010. So that sort of brings me to my original point that the threat landscape in Bangladesh cannot be looked at just looking at Bangladesh alone, because it has a deeper imprint on the region and outside the region, as we see with the case of Nafees. He underwent a process of radicalization even before he entered the United States. Links have been found between him and groups in Bangladesh even before he entered the United States. So when he entered the US and when he was exposed to more radical ideology, the rest we know of, like what happened and the sting operation and so on. So I think these issues need to be very closely looked at.
I just want to share one information with you, is that we did a one-year study with the Bangladeshi diaspora based in London. And we came out with very, very disturbing findings. The Bangladeshi diaspora living in London, in many cases, were more radicalized than Bangladeshis back in Bangladesh. So we found pathways to cross-pollination, radical thoughts going across from United Kingdom to Bangladesh.
And vice versa.
So the issues of diaspora radicalization in a very interconnected world is a major issue to be concerned with. We'll have very quick two last questions. One is Farooq, and then the professor.
You have made that point.
Then Farooq, please.
I'm Farooq, studying City in National Defense University.
In Washington.
Yes, sir. My question relates to, and I'm happy to see that you are looking at the strategic framework for city in Bangladesh.
Right.
What in your mind is that strategic city infrastructure? Are you looking at POS, political opportunity structure issues, which has led to many groups in Algeria, in Arab world, Arab Spring, you've seen, that has led the groups to be radicalized and go into the field of this terrorism. What would you look at Bangladesh and say where we need to strategically look at that POS issues, political opportunity structure?
So if I understand you correctly, you're talking about a denial of political space for groups so that they... right?
Absolutely.
Or fostering groups.
Yeah.
Yes.
No, I think it's an important question that you raise. I think it's important for us to also ensure, and I think the United States has been advocating this for quite some time, that Islamist parties and Islamist groups which are in the political space, they need to be given that space to ensure that they're not driven to the fringe and they don't turn out to be, they don't resort to other tactics rather than being in the political space to get to the main, to get to power. I think that's very important. But in terms of the city infrastructure or city architecture that I was talking about, I'm essentially looking at the kind of institutional capacity building that Bangladesh needs to undertake. And I hasten to add that I'm not a dreamy-eyed optimist here, that I think that it can be done in one day. We have other challenges. We have severe resource constraints, being a developing country with a huge population. I'm mindful of that, but I think at the same time it is very important for us to take a fresh look, take a step back and see how we can overhaul the city architecture to meet with the new and emerging challenges, because I'd again like to highlight it's a clear and present danger that we live with, and with the emergence of splinter groups, with the advent of urban radicalization, with the diaspora cross-pollination, it's quite an unhappy situation that we are looking at.
I think we have to end the session here. We could have continued discussion, but for the lack of time, we'll have to end the session here. What I would like to say, what I said in the beginning, that the challenge is great, and we have grave challenges of radicalization and terrorism facing Bangladesh. But the good news is that the people of Bangladesh and our governments and our political parties are committed to facing the challenge. We are particularly concerned of the fact that if there is political instability for the reason that the government refuses to give a credible election, that space will be very quickly occupied by terrorist groups.
True.
And that is a challenge we have to face now. And this is the kind of the cycle we have gone through in Syria, in all other places. The moment you have political instability, a dysfunctional politics, a space that is created by confrontational politics, a space that is created by governments who become stubborn and don't listen to their own people, that space is very, very quickly occupied by militant and terrorist groups. We are seeing the early signs of that in Bangladesh. For the last 3-4 years, we did not see many of the groups rising up and trying to link up with each other within the country and regionally. But that is a symptom we are now beginning to see. If we go through more political uncertainties and poor political instability in the coming weeks and months, this is going to be a very wonderful ground for the terrorists to survive and reactivate themselves. I would like to say that not only as Bangladeshis, as all of you ladies and gentlemen are friends of Bangladesh and people concerned with international stability and system, must come together to say that there has to be political stability leading up to elections, meaning that there has to be a credible election which is inclusive, held under a neutral government by any name you call it. And that is the only way to maintain stability in Bangladesh. I'm happy to say that both our governments have shown commitment to CD. The current government has continued the work that was left by BNP and has continued with the same spirit and has come up with the slogan of zero tolerance, which is extremely gratifying. The opposition, the BNP, has come out with their own statement that they say that we will observe complete denial of space to any radicalization and any terrorism. And that is a future that we want to see from the opposition and the government. Thank you all very much for attending the session. Thank you.